Space, the Final Frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. I'm Eddie Webb.
And I'm Chris Spivey.
And today we talk about Star Trek on Genreless. Hey all, and welcome to the first episode of Genreless, where Chris and I talk about cool genre stuff that we love and dig into this whole idea of what shows can be and what they're all about. Before we kind of dive into who we are and what this is all about, Chris, this was really your initial idea. So maybe you could talk initially about what you were wanting the show to be and what you're hoping this will turn into.
So great. Much like a pilot in a TV show, there's initial concept compared to execution. Mm-hmm. When we were having the podcast together, it was just fun actually getting to riff with you about different shows, as we both have a real love of Doctor Who, Sherlock, and a bunch of other things. Mm-hmm. And it occurred to me that I don't get to just geek out with someone that likes similar shows or even talk about the different array of shows and movies because they have such a heavy influence on us. And I mm-hmm. wanted the opportunity to kind of do that with you. And I figured what better way to start than why not a podcast?
Totally. And then when you pitched it to me, I was really into the idea of it because it's almost like a TV book club or a video book club, because it gives a chance to kind of watch or rewatch some stuff I haven't watched in a while. Just talk about it. And a podcast is a good way to kind of give us a chance to get together and just have fun talking about things. So for context, both of us, met through the tabletop RPG industry. So we're both designers in the tabletop RPG space. So we're not going to really talk a ton about tabletop RPGs, but it's probably going to come up here and there.
It's kind of hard to avoid.
Right. We're just going to, it's like, this reminds me of this one game. Oh no, I did it again. It happened. and like Chris said, this is kind of the pilot. So we're feeling our way around this, but, we do have kind of a rough structure we're looking at. So we're both pretty busy. So we're going to do this kind of in seasons. So we're going to record a handful of episodes about one kind of overarching topic or genre. In this case, we're talking about particularly space opera for this season. And we're going to do about 6 to 8 episodes. Still a little fuzzy on that. Those will come out every 2 weeks. They'll come out on the 1st and the 15th. And then we'll take a break. We'll figure out what we're going to do for the next group of episodes, and those come up when we're ready to kind of start putting them up. So it's definitely going to be haphazard. It's also going to be a little unedited. We're only going to edit for things like, oh, I need to cut that out kind of stuff. But otherwise, you're going to hear bumps and quirks because it's very excuse for us to kind of hang out and chat. And then we want to give you the whole experience of what that experience is like.
And if you like it, to come back and chat at us and talk about shows, because one of the things that I love to do is sort of like geek out about whatever the show is, get into some of the different nuts and bolts of it, because mm-hmm. even every single show has its own flow and politics associated with it. And it's yep. interesting to see what other people take from it and what they use.
And that's totally fair. Actually, that's something that might be worth even digging into right now is I think we're both come from the standpoint of all art is political. So we're going to obviously have some kind of our shape and our perspectives are going to shape these discussions. I am a cisgender white man, but I am disabled. I have had hearing loss my entire life. And also I grew up in the mid 80s punk subculture. So all that stuff's definitely going to be shaping kind of where I'm coming from on this.
And I'm a cisgendered black man who's a military veteran who still has some wounds from my time in the military and raised in the Deep South. So that has definitely influenced my political opinions and why I am somewhat, I guess you would say, an activist and do protesting and marching when I can. And that sort of goes through most of my art also.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And part of the structure is that we're each going to choose shows that bounce back and forth. So next episode, Chris is going to host and back and forth. And so we kind of pick shows that both we love, but also with an eye towards, here's some interesting to talk about. But I picked Star Trek because we decided we were going to do kind of space opera theme for this. And
Do we want to talk about the riff? Sorry. Do we want to talk about the riff that we sort of did back and forth before we nailed down doing space opera?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Yeah.
Sort of, because there are a lot of different genres, and eventually we may touch on all of them if this really picks off and we love doing it, how I hope we will. But then it became a matter of figuring out what was the first thing that we wanted to approach together. And then we hit on sci-fi, but even sci-fi itself, there's sort of different layers of sci-fi. You have like the hard sci-fi, then you've got sort of the soft one, then you have a space opera that is different than both of those concepts in of itself, as it's more almost fantasy-esque in space for some aspects.
Yep. Right. And that's kind of why I felt Star Trek would be a good one to start off with, because it's space opera existed before Star Trek, but really a lot of our understanding of space opera now stems pretty strongly from Trek. So I wanted to talk about the original episode or the original series. And my history with it is I grew up watching these episodes. My mom was also a huge Star Trek fan. And so whenever there were reruns on broadcast television, we watched them over and over again. When Next Generation came on, we watched it every week together. So I have a very long love of Star Trek. You know, we went to Star Trek conventions together. And so it has a very soft space in my heart for that. But also, it's been interesting to go back and rewatch them recently. In fact, I've been watching the remastered versions that are on Paramount Plus, which are the kind of digitally remastered, gone from stock. There's some new visual effects. And it's been long enough since I've watched Trek that I didn't exactly know, and this was really obvious, I didn't exactly know which ones were touched up effects and which ones were the original effects. There's some that are like, well, that's obviously not happening in the 60s, but you know, there's other ones. Like, is that a model shot? I don't know. Probably not. Who knows? Did you have much experience with the original show?
I'm actually coming from the exact opposite spectrum of that. My experience with Star Trek was minimal for a long time. Mm. I think I first got into it probably have been season 2 or 3 of Deep Space Nine.
Okay.
And Deep Space Nine sort of became the Star Trek that I loved. And I went back and watched some of the other Star Trek. And then I watched some of it sort of hit or miss after that. I can even say with certainty, I haven't even seen all the original movies yet.
Oh, wow. Okay. This is actually going to be a good conversation, I think. And that's kind of what we're hoping for, is that there's going to be some shows we both love, and there's going to be some shows where it's like, oh, I'm not really that familiar with it. So that, I think those make for good conversations. But anyway, so we don't have to force each other to watch like seasons and seasons and seasons of a show. We kind of agreed on, we're going to talk about a pilot and then a couple of representative episodes of the show from the person who put the show forward's perspective. And so I picked The Cage, The Corbomite Maneuver, and Mirror Mirror. So if you want to watch those along with us, or like watch those and come back and listen to this, those are three shows we're going to talk about. We're probably going to talk about spoilers about those three episodes specifically. We'll try to avoid talking about other episodes, so if people want to go and watch the rest of the show, they can, relatively unspoiled. But we're going to talk about those three probably in some level. And I picked those because I really feel like this is a good example of why you should never watch just the pilot of a show and assume that's what the show's about. Because The Cage is really different from the actual show it becomes.
All right, can I just say that I love The Cage?
Really?
I did. I like the pacing of it. I like the concept of it. Now, the thing that I guess we should also put in right now is like our universal stamp going across all episodes is that we're taking the shows in context for the era that they were aired.
Yeah.
But we're also acknowledging that as they should have been done better. I want to establish that now before we get into the discussions that we're going to have, because it's an important thing to note.
No, totally. The politics have changed. We're trying to talk about them in the context of the time, but also we can't ignore the fact that we're looking at this from a 2021 lens.
Yes. But that having been said, I love the concept. I love the pacing and sort of some of the action suspense that was associated with The Cage. And I liked Pike as a captain better than I actually like Kirk. I said it.
No, I'm
third down.
I actually am agreeing with you, but I'm curious, because before I go into my nerd perspective, I mean, what about Pike do you like better than Kirk?
Pike has sort of I don't want to say gravitas, but sort of a weariness to him for someone that's been doing the job for so long and mm-hmm. is trying to find a reason to keep doing the job. That is, that in of itself is a struggle and conflict of a character. And mm-hmm. that is great to see. And to have that be in the first episode, almost in the first scenes, that you've established who this person is.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a really key point for what I love about the original series is that the show works best when it's focusing on characters, because the sci-fi concepts, frankly, you can give or take, and a lot of them are just bonkers. There are episodes like Spock's Brain, which by the title alone, you have a pretty good sense of what that show's about when you spoil it. I mean,
let's give him a little bit of credit though, because think about Doctor Who and the Brain of Morbius.
No, that's fair. That's fair. And oh man, there's some rough Doctor Who. I really will at some point we'll have to talk to him. Speaking into like the Baker era, because there's both amazing heights and deep lows. But anyway, I'm kind of with you in the sense that the Cage presents forth a really interesting concept of this is an established crew on an established ship that's been doing this for a while, and Pike's coming at it like, I've kind of done, you know, eventually like he's not quite sure why he's doing this. And then at the end of the Cage, kind of the premise of like, okay, well, I've been reinvigorated. This experience with alien cultures reminds me why we do this. So it's an interesting character arc for a pilot. But then when Kirk and the crew get established, I picked the Corbett maneuver because it's kind of really the first rebooted pilot, lack of a better term. It's not actually the first episode. That's where No Man's Gone before, but it was the first one that the actors filmed together. So you see the early dynamics of the actors finding their characters. And it's very much perspective of this is a relatively brand new crew. And it's later retconned that the Enterprise is the same Enterprise that was in the Cage. But at the time, it was probably a brand new ship, and they're just starting their mission. And Kirk is a young, arrogant captain, whereas Pike is a little more world-weary. And even that one episode, you get the feeling like he's made some hard decisions and is probably willing to make more of those.
And so that even gets sort of like flashbacks to some of his previous adventures in the dream illusionscape that they create for him.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows you the type of person that he is, because he even knows that he's in this trap and that they want him to do this thing. But there is a, as far as he discovers, like another human life that is dependent on him to do the responsibility and job that he was dedicated his life supposedly to do. And yeah. So that conflict and struggle is great to see. And I know as a former soldier for myself, that is something that I can associate with.
No, I was going to say that. I mean, so do you also empathize with the conversation he has with the doctor, like, you know, thing, the whole, there are things that someone tell their partner, don't tell their doctor scene. Well, I'm curious what you thought about that.
Very much so. Cause, it's like someone that might've actually fought in a war or had talked to someone that's done that. And mm-hmm. they sort of translated that into this medium. And that is something great to watch, because if we think about it, also the show I think originally aired in, this is like me not knowing all my Star Trek history now, 1966.
Yeah.
And World War II was like about 20 years beforehand. Mm-hmm. So you've got veterans from that war that are watching this show that may be sort of like resonating with some of those tones that are right there for them.
It's interesting you brought that up, because part of the reason why my mom became a fan and I became a fan was because her father was a fan, and he was a Korean War vet from the Air Force. So I never made that connection until you pointed it out, but I think that may be part of it, is the ideological view of the military in respects. This is how we hope the military will be, but also recognizing maybe some of that kind of weariness in at least some of the characters. In the crew that comes after the Cage, you know, I think McCoy kind of picks up some of that particular slack of I've seen this before and is kind of wanting to shoot straight and say the things that maybe nobody else wants to say. But it's interesting to see Pike kind of more embody that, because so yeah, I'm kind of with you. It's not controversial to me, but I know it's controversial in general. Kirk was never been a strong captain for me. In the original show, I always more closely identified with Spock, personally, because I've been that kid who is too smart for the room, and that makes things awkward for everyone. And that's not me being arrogant. I mean, I was in a special class of courses for gifted children, and there's a whole psychological trauma that goes around being gifted and then growing up and realizing, oh, actually everyone tells you you can do anything, and then you get in the real world and realize, no, you can't. Crash into the ground after that. But I mean, you know, I grew up with, like, you know, everyone telling me how amazing and smart I was, and then realizing I can't show that I'm struggling in any way, because that's going to be a problem. And so watching Spock struggle with the kind of his emotional thing, and especially in these early episodes when he doesn't have the cool Vulcan exterior that we now recognize in Star Trek. He's much more emotional. He has outbursts. He's loud sometimes. You almost get to struggle more in the early episodes, where in later episodes it becomes kind of that very smooth, default, always calm Leonard Nimoy delivery we become used to, and it's now so iconic.
Do we know if the writers made that choice, or was that an acting choice originally by Nimoy himself?
My understanding was that a lot of it was shaped by Nimoy. For example, the Vulcan salute was actually something that he saw, I believe, if I remember the interview correctly, his father or one of his relatives do in a synagogue once. So his Jewish upbringing was definitely a huge part of how he shaped that character. And initially, I think he was just trying to figure out how to get the concept across on the screen. But once television, because some of this is also television fidelity, right? Again, we're talking about the context of time. We're hitting a point where not everyone has a color television yet. That's one of the reasons why, for example, the uniforms are so brightly colored, is because they had to read in grayscale, potentially, for some people who didn't have televisions. And so the audio also wasn't great on these old television sets. So he was trying to find a way to get this character across. And then as television technology, you know, was getting better, and also people got more confidence in the idea, he realized he could play that more subtly and would still get across to the audience in a way. He was initially concerned that he didn't feel like it could get across to the audience. So he advocated more for kind of pulling back, because he was worried that things like the eyebrow raise wouldn't read, right? Or the sarcasm wouldn't read on TV.
That is so iconic and perfect.
It is. And so initially there's a lot more, again, you see, like, in Corbomite Maneuver, there's a lot more body language in his portrayal. Whereas in Mirror Mirror, which is the third one we saw, that's been season two. It shows you all the characters in a very different way. But you see Spock on both sides, both his quote-unquote evil version and his version we understand. And the acting and the body language is all ramped down much more considerably from those first two episodes. I think because he was, again, the audience was buying into the character, and so they could read the nuance in that those first couple episodes, people maybe weren't quite sure what they needed to do there. And actually, going into Mirror Mirror, because that's, again, such an archetype of the evil counterpart trope, like, to the point where the evil goatee comes from this episode. That's where it starts. So I'm curious, what did you think of Mirror Mirror specifically?
So Mirror Mirror was actually one that I'd seen before, and mm-hmm. it was one of the few that I'd seen, simply because so many people referenced it. And mm-hmm. there was even a Deep Space Nine episode about it. So the geek yes. in me wanted to go back and find that touch point. So I go, that's where it came from. Mm-hmm. I loved it because Spock's consistency in both versions of Spock, like, he was never really evil. I would say he was more, I don't want to say practical is not quite the right word, pragmatic mm-hmm. in the world that the character existed in, and made those choices that would allow the character to do what they wanted to do and still be successful. Like, one of the cruxes was, I don't want to be captain. So I'm telling you this so you don't mess up, so I don't have to kill you.
Yeah.
So I can continue to do this thing that I enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's brilliant characterization right there. That's,
Yeah, because, I mean, it's ostensibly it's an episode about Kirk, but really it's an episode about Spock. And you're right, you learn so much of the character from seeing his counterpart. And yeah, it is textured and complex in a way you not expect in 60s television.
And it was also interesting to see that the comment about the alternate versions of them couldn't pretend to be the main universe versions. Mm-hmm. But it would have been interesting if Spock wasn't there to have seen if anyone else would have caught it as quickly as Spock did and what could have potentially happened.
Yeah, but I mean, it's on the one hand, like that would be interesting. But on the other hand, the one cut you get of the mirror universe Kirk, how so over the top that Shatner is playing it. He's screaming and threatening people. That's like, it probably would have been pretty fast. It's like, if that's how he normally acts, it probably would have been like, this guy's way too down low. Something is up.
But who aboard the crew, though, at that time would have been able to have basically had him arrested almost immediately? Because that's one of the crux points. Because even if you see your commander is out there, do you want to be the ensign that goes, "Captain, to the brig"?
Right. No, that's a good point. That's a good point.
And Sulu and Chekhov are already basically piloting the ship. So you've got him moving all throughout the ship to do all those things. Like if Scotty had been the person in the transporter room, I don't think mm-hmm. Scotty would have tried to have stopped, who is obviously not Kirk.
No, that's a really good point. That's because they probably would have been too afraid of what he would do.
Mm-hmm.
So and then that sets up interesting, again, texture for when you go back to the characters that we know. And jumping ahead, but I mean, I think Deep Space Nine also did that with their mirror episodes very well, is that you see these characters in a way that you don't really see them, and that gives you more context and more grist for the characters we do know and love. This is a perfect example of that. So I jumped over Corbett maneuver. I want to go back to that because aside from being the kind of quote-unquote real pilot of Star Trek, it's also a fantastic episode of what's known as a bottle episode, which is the almost everything in that episode is shot from the Enterprise sets. There are no other locations really for that entire episode except for the one alien ship they go to, and it's so clearly redressed from the Enterprise sets. It's a great episode of just, to me, this is one of the few times, one of the things I like about Kirk is the trope of talking machines to death or talking, I mean, or talking people into not doing things. So I'm curious what you thought about that dynamic, specifically kind of like of Kirk's continuing, let's say diplomatic negotiations, when that entirely true. I'm curious what you thought about that whole scenario though.
I would almost call it more of a con artist or a huckster, but we can say diplomat if you like.
That's what the Action After Report would say.
It's nice to see, but then it was great to see that because then that also goes back to, I know about, I forgot what it's called now. The Kobayashi Maru, the test that you're supposed to fail that Kirk somehow always seems to win or pass through. And that would highlight that aspect of the character that even though the ship is about to be exploded, I'm going to do this incredibly risky gambit that if you even partially don't believe that it's going to work, you're going to destroy us immediately. And it was good to actually see that in one of the earlier episodes, know that that was a character trait that was always there.
Right. Yeah. That kind of, I always kind of think of it as, this is why charisma is a useful stat, you know, right? It's like you can just talk your way out of situations. And it, because really, yeah, the entire Corbett maneuver is basically him just straight up lying about what his ship can and can't do and trusting that the other side will blink first. The ending is bolted on, frankly. It's like, no, I was just testing you. This is all fun. Huh? It was just a weak ending, I think. But everything leading up to that was just surprisingly tense. And to go back to your earlier point, it was slower paced than The Cage. But 460s television is actually pretty gripping in terms of pacing. Actually, Mirror Mirror is paced pretty well, too.
No, I wouldn't even say that it was a slower pace in The Cage. I would just say it's sort of they put the suspense in a different format and way for you to engage with. Like, that's The fair. Cage, it was almost more visual and you can, like, see physical threats. and there were more there for you to interact with compared to the Corbinite maneuver, where it's all in like the reactions, like the timing, the music, and that slow, steady buildup. And you're inevitably thinking that, is this going to be the end of the crew? At least back in the 60s when it aired, because it was like their, I think, aired as their 10th episode. Yeah. And at that point in time, you could be, well, I guess that was it for this show. It was nice to watch it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even if you look at the way it was aired, the crew almost completely changed over from the original episode to Where Has Gone Before. Several crew members have died in the first few episodes, and they heavily hint towards another character potentially dying in Kobayashi Maru, or no, in Cormac Maneuver. So, I mean, yeah, it wasn't entirely off the table. There is a media literacy factor, I think, because, for example, again, kind of jumping shows, but there was a very kind of infamous Doctor Who episode where the Doctor's head was put underwater, and then that was the cliffhanger. And so, a parents' rights activist implied that the kids were very concerned that the Doctor was going to die after that. And it's like, the show's called Doctor Who. Basic media literacy tells you the character's not going to die. Similarly, at the end of Sherlock season 2, when Sherlock jumps off a building, spoiler for 125-year-old story that I was imagining, I had people.
But I've never read the book. No.
Right?
Oh, sorry.
Right. I literally got people on Twitter mad at me about this. They're like going, you know what? Why are you spoiling the fact Sherlock comes back? The show is called Sherlock. Right. You know? But the show is called Star Trek. It is about the journey. And so it is entirely possible that characters could have been killed. It's not misreading the media to think, oh, this actually might be, maybe we follow a different ship after this, or maybe we follow a different captain. It's happened once before, so it could happen again. So it's the stress, the strikes there, period of time, could have been very, very real. Whereas sometimes the threat is just the thing you get out of because, okay, I recognize what the show is. I know what's going to happen here. This is the death trap superhero gets put in. We know the superhero is going to get out. So we're just watching to see how they do it. But this was again, even the mirror, it's like, it's not possible. Some of those crew members may just have been stuck there. They may never have come back. It's at that stage of season 2, we've seen these characters for a while. It's less likely at that point. It's like, you know, we're probably not going to lose or Sulu or Scotty because we know those characters. But, you know, the red shirt, you know, genre, it's like, you know, the one actor we don't recognize, yeah, they're going to die. But we reached that point with Mirror Mirror. But at Corbinite Maneuver, we don't know who besides the three people whose names we see on the beginning of the show, we don't know which of these characters may or may not be killed. I mean, Uhura's still in a yellow dress. I mean, so we don't know.
So then I guess I am curious. Mm-hmm. If you had to do a quick comparison and contrast between the Cage and the Corbinite Maneuver, if one of those was going to be your initial pilot for a full run season, for which one would it be and why?
That's tough. I think it depends on what kind of show you want. Because it's interesting, I just talked about how you can't really tell from a pilot show is going to be. If you were watch Corbinite Maneuver, I think you would get a very different sense of what Star Trek really is after that episode. Because Star Trek is more like The Cage, as a general rule, right? It's sci-fi adventure with a strong moral spine from a 60s perspective, but it's sci-fi adventure. So if you started with Corbinite Maneuver and that was your pilot, I think the show you get probably much more like the reboot of Battlestar Galactica. It would be tense. It would be insular. It would be inside ships. It would be character driven. So to get the show of Star Trek, they'd recognize it. The Cage would be a better actual proper first pilot because it showcases better what the show is going to be. There's character dynamics, but you're also exploring new planets, and the conflict with alien cultures leads to confusion and a better understanding of the human condition. That's all in The Cage. It's not in the Corbinite Maneuver. Mirror Mirror is closer to a good, solid Star Trek episode. And there's character stuff there, but it's also punching people in the face and running around and, you know, dressing in
cool costumes. Kirk's legendary jump kick.
I mean, honestly, if I wanted to get a show that is like Star Trek, The Cage would actually be a better pilot in my mind.
Very cool.
And it's interesting because, like, from a 2021 perspective, for example, Pike is now getting his own show finally on Paramount Plus. I think there is people starting to recognize there's a mine there to be, or there's a depth there to be mined and potential interesting dramatic drama. I know there was a Marvel comic book issues that also handled the Pike era of the Enterprise.
Oh, all right. And we have to track that down.
Yeah, it was out in the 90s. So Marvel's 90 art, take that for what you will. But I think it was called Star Trek First Voyages. But yeah, there's been some exploration of that. And there's interesting drama there. One more thing kind of before we start to wrap up is we keep mentioning this is kind of the 60s. This is large political. Star Trek is interesting because it is both very clearly a very 60s white liberal view of the world, and also has a strong pro-military dynamic in it by its design. It's interesting to watch back because it's almost like a Rorschach blot of finding your politics inside of this show. Because you can probably find something in there to gravitate to. Obviously, bigots are not going to find much in the show to divide them because this show is very clearly strongly against that. But, there's colonization in there that you can genuinely find that narrative if you want to and be like, yeah, it's kind of a pro-colonization narrative in a lot of respects.
Originally pitched almost like Wagon Train in Space?
Yes, and I think it's part of it is that it's not obvious there's a Western DNA to it, but there is some in there. It is much more kind of, we got a bunch of people onto a wagon, we're going to unexplored parts of the world and seeing if we can live there.
But at the same time, it was also, while it was very much a white show, they did have a somewhat more diverse cast of characters, although they didn't fully use them, than many other shows at the time. Like, hands down.
No, absolutely. For its time, it was extremely inclusive. It is the show that is known for showing the first interracial kiss on public television, to which the team got death threats for. And the show was actually preempted in a lot of Southern markets. Interesting behind-the-scenes story I've recently learned.
Is this Kirk, about Michelle Nichols?
Yes, it's about Shatner and Nichols did the scene. Originally, even the producers were a little unsure about that scene. So they had one scene where they actually kiss, and then they said, okay, we're doing a scene where you're about to kiss, but you don't do it, and we'll cut away. So we don't actually show the kiss. And every shot they took of that alternate scene, Shatner would cross his eyes, or Michelle Nichols would say, blurt something out. They would always ruin those takes until they ran out of time, and they couldn't shoot the alternate take. So they just flat out sabotaged the second take.
Well, and the other cool thing is, well, at least I thought this was pretty cool. I don't know if you knew about this one, but Nichelle Nichols was actually going to thought about leaving the show. And the only thing that stopped her was that, I think it was a call from Dr. Martin Luther King,
who encouraged her
to stay on the show to tell her that black children and other women around the country needed to see themselves represented on screen.
That's really cool. I had no idea. And I think that's great. I know Sulu was similar for a lot of Japanese American people, particularly after World War II. It's very important to see them on the screen. And weirdly, something you don't talk about much is Chekhov's inclusion. Because this was height of Cold War.
Yeah.
And to have a Russian character in a predominantly positive role was unusual. So that's another kind of bit of inclusivity that doesn't get talked about as much as the actors of color, but I mean, it's still as important, I think. It's a very progressive show for its time. Some parts of it have not aged well. Weirdly, some of it is contextual, like the fact that all the women wear miniskirts. But I know I read an interview with Michelle Nichols about that. She's like, everyone wore miniskirts. I wore miniskirts, you know, to the show. I mean, that's just what women wore. So from her perspective, she never saw it as sexualizing. It's like, that's just the fashion. So that's something that it really is not aged well, but also that's a very specific 60s zeitgeist that I think that we've now lost some context for. But there are other parts that, you know, you look at it and it's like, that probably could have been better.
Yeah. But that was, I think we went into this knowing that was going to be part of it. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, totally. As we move through, not intentionally, but we've kind of sort of roughly done this chronologically. So, I mean, I suspect as we move through, we'll, you know, see things, some things change, some things better, some things weirdly get worse.
One step forward, two steps back.
That's genre television in a nutshell, man. You know, it's something. And I think that's what's interesting about this idea as a podcast for me is that pop culture looks down on genre television, genre movies, comic books, pulp novels, and it gives them space to try things that other spaces can't do. Like the fact that the X-Men was initially just a terribly selling title, and so Chris Claremont's like, well, I'm going to start stealth putting in LGBTQ representation as much as I can. The code will let me get away with. And in Star Trek, the same way, it's like, it's just a sci-fi show. So, you know, no one's really going to watch if we do this until everyone's suddenly watching. So, I mean, it is a chance to push the envelope a bit more in terms of the overall cultural conversation. And when it's done well, it becomes iconic. And when it's done badly, it's done very badly. So,
I guess the crux of that would also be that it's important that even if you're doing that, and no one's watching and you're doing great work, that when people start watching, you keep doing the work. For instance, right. I'm going to call out a show. So when Sleepy Hollow first aired, I was watching Sleepy Hollow and I was really digging Sleepy Hollow. It had Abby as a lead who mm-hmm. was a great character. It was this great, strong black woman leading the show and her like white spunky sidekick of Ichabod Crane, who is not temporarily displaced, but not in his right time. Mm-hmm. The show, no one expected it to do well. In the end of the first season, great reviews and everything. Mm-hmm. And by the middle of the second season, they had almost written her character out to make the show all about Ichabod. Oh. And then his, I think, white love interest. But I'm not certain because I stopped watching it.
Right.
And they also got rid of the black male police chief. Mm. And it became a very just white focused show. And then I think it canceled shortly after that.
Yeah.
That's someone that used the momentum and all this great opportunity and then squandered it when eyes actually turned to the show that could have potentially made progressive change.
Right. I think Star Trek didn't last long enough to go that route, honestly. I mean, I feel like they were starting to really get their feet under them season two. Season three is generally kind of weak, and it got canceled shortly afterwards. And I think it's mostly because it was a weak show. They were running out of ideas. But it is clear that Roddenberry had a very strong vision, and that vision was very clearly meant to be a progressive one. Again, from a white liberal standpoint from the 60s, but still, they're trying really hard, and I respect the hell out of the effort. So I guess to kind of wrap things up, since you said you're only kind of somewhat familiar with Star Trek, has anything you've watched made you go, I want to see more of that? Or do you feel like you've pretty much got that and you're happy to let that sit?
Are we talking about the original series or the series that came afterwards?
The original series, specifically. Just the original series.
Yes. After seeing the Cage, actually after seeing the three episodes that we've seen, I have enough mm-hmm. interest to sort of go back from the beginning and start watching it when I have time, sporadically, which is something I would not have done before.
Oh, cool. Excellent.
So I blame you now for this red hole of sinking time that I have to invest in something else. Thank you.
That is going to be the downside of this because I'm genuinely afraid, like after like a couple of seasons, it's going to be like, I have a watch list of like a million things to do now. but luckily, it's only three seasons. I mean, so it's like about maybe 60, 70 episodes. And for folks who are also interested in watching it, one thing I do recommend, if you are pressed for time, there are lots of lists online. Just do a search for like Star Trek Essential episodes. And that usually gets you kind of the high points. And especially in this 60s era, they're really episodic. There's not a lot of connectivity between episodes. Like a couple things, like a new character gets introduced and sticks around kind of continuity, but you don't have long character arcs. So if you want to just like get like bits and pieces of Star Trek, you absolutely can. You could do 10 essential episodes, 20 essential episodes, whatever you feel like you have time for. Just do some searching for it. And there's some really great lists for that. But
my suggestions.
Go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, if people really want to get into it, while we're not sponsored by them, if they want to, Paramount Plus is probably one of the best ways to watch Star Trek right now, because they have all the different series. Mm-hmm. They have some of the remastered ones, and I know that's where I watched it too. So,
yeah, originally I would recommend Netflix, but now, yeah, Paramount Plus is really a really solid place, and also has some newer shows too, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point. But it's a great show. And if you really are craving more original Star Trek after this, there also was a season of the animated series, which is interesting. But it does have
all the original 60s animation.
Yes, it's very 60s animation, but also has the original voice actors. So, I mean, it is rare in the sense that it has the entire original cast doing their voices again. So it's pretty close to canon in that respect. So cool. So that's it for this episode. Next week we're going to talk about, Chris,
Babylon 5. Very excited, and I think there's actually talk of a reboot now, so I guess timing for that's almost perfect, so we can like jump ahead of that wave and give some of our initial thoughts about it.
Yeah, I have thoughts about that too. It's been a long time since I watched Babylon 5, so I'm excited to get back into it. So that is it for the genre list. So see you in 2 weeks and catch you later.
Thanks, everybody.